All right, strap in, everyone. Today we're going deep on a Supreme Court case that really gets you thinking about what religion actually means, you know, legally speaking. Mm-hmm. We're talking Welch v. United States from way back in 1970, and it's still sparking debate today.
You know, it's fascinating because Welch landed right smack in the middle of the Vietnam War, back when the draft was a massive issue and everyone was arguing about conscientious objection.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That context is so important. Vietnam War era. And our main guy, Elliot Welch, is facing, like, the very real possibility of being sent to fight. So he applies for conscientious objector status. But, and here's the kicker, he edits his application, takes out the words religious training.
And that's where the whole thing hinges. The law at that time, specifically Section 6J of the Universal Military Training and Service Act, it said you could get out of military service if your objections were because of religious training and belief.
So Welch is basically saying, I'm against war, morally, but I don't want to call it religious. And the draft board's response is, nope, not going to cut it. You're drafted.
You got it. And boom, this huge legal battle kicks off. The core question in Welch v. United States becomes, can a deep moral objection, even if it's not tied to traditional religion, be enough for that exemption?
It really makes you wonder, what did the court even consider religious back then? Was it just believing in God, or could it be, you know, something more?
Well, before Welch, there was another key case, United States v. Seeger, 1965. That case introduced this idea of a parallel beliefs test.
Parallel beliefs. Break that down for me.
Imagine your beliefs are like parallel lines running next to traditional religious beliefs. They might not be the same, but they kind of function in the same way in your life. The Seeger case said, even if you don't believe in a traditional God, if your deeply held beliefs work like a religion does in your life, they might count for the exemption.
So Seeger kind of cracked open the door to a broader definition of religious when it came to conscientious objection.
Right. But Welch pushes it even further. Remember, Welch specifically said he wasn't using a religious label. So the court had to figure out if this parallel beliefs thing from Seeger still worked when someone like Welch just flat out rejected that religion label.
Okay, this is getting pretty complex. So what did the court ultimately decide in Welch? Did they go with the draft board or with Welch's right to object based on his morals?
The majority opinion, written by Justice Black, focused on the sincerity and depth of Welch's beliefs, not on where those beliefs came from.
So it didn't actually matter if Welch called his beliefs religious. It was more about, like, how much he believed in them.
Yeah, exactly. The court even went so far as to say that someone's objection could be based on reading, I don't know, sociology books, for example. It wasn't about traditional religious teachings. It was about what those beliefs meant in that person's life.
Hold on. So are you saying I could theoretically get out of the draft because of my deep love for sociology? That's wild.
Maybe not quite that simple, but it shows how the court was moving away from this rigid religion as we know it definition. They came up with a two-part test. First, are the beliefs moral, ethical, or religious? And second, are they held as strongly and with the same conviction as traditional religious beliefs?
So it's about the intensity, the genuineness of the belief, not the label.
Exactly. And this is where things get even more interesting. Because the court wasn't unanimous. We've got both a concurring and a dissenting opinion that highlight just how tricky this case is.
Right. Let's break down those differing opinions. What were the other justices saying?
Sure. So Justice Harlan actually agreed with the outcome, you know, that Welch should get the exemption. But he wasn't thrilled with how the majority got there. He called their interpretation a lobotomy of the law, basically arguing it erased any real distinction between religious and non-religious beliefs.
A lobotomy. Wow. That's pretty strong language. Can you expand on why Justice Harlan had such a problem with the majority's logic?
Well, he was worried about the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. You know, that part that says the government can't favor one religion over another, or even favor religion over non-religion. Harlan felt the majority was getting too close to putting religious beliefs above non-religious ones, even if they didn't intend to.
That's an important point. So Harlan thought Welch deserved the exemption, but thought the court's reasoning was, well, constitutionally shaky.
Right. He would have preferred to just scrap Section 6J entirely because it seemed to be giving preferential treatment to religious objectors.
Okay, so we have the majority saying it's about how deeply you believe, and Harlan raising those constitutional red flags. What about the dissent? What was their take on all this?
The dissenting opinion, led by Justice White, was pretty straightforward. They basically said the court was rewriting the law, plain and simple. Their view was that if Congress wanted to include secular beliefs in the exemption, they would have said so directly.
Sounds like a classic stick to the letter of the law argument.
Exactly. Justice White felt the majority was stepping out of line, almost making new laws instead of interpreting the existing one. They thought the court went too far in reinterpreting the statute.
Okay, so we've got these three distinct viewpoints on the case, each raising important questions about how judges interpret laws and that tricky balance between individual rights and what the government can do. But before we get into the lasting impact of Welsh and what it means for us today, let's dig a little deeper into those differing opinions.
So yeah, we've got these three different opinions, each with his own take on, you know, how to interpret the law and how to balance individual rights with what the government can do. But they all come back to that big question. What does religion really mean when we're talking about conscientious objection?
It's like Welsh blew the doors wide open, didn't it?
Yeah.
Before this, conscientious objector status was pretty much limited to traditional religious beliefs. But Welsh said, nope, deep moral or ethical convictions count too, even if they're not tied to any organized religion. That's a huge change.
Oh, absolutely. You're totally right. Welsh broadened the scope of conscientious objection in a big way. It's not just about following specific religious rules anymore. The court acknowledged the power of an individual's conscience, even if it's rooted in, like, secular ideas, philosophy, personal ethics, things like that.
I can see how that could be groundbreaking, but also kind of messy. It makes me think about those real-life scenarios where someone might object to a specific war, but not for religious reasons. Where do you draw the line? What makes a deeply held moral conviction different from, like, just a strong personal opinion?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Welsh said your beliefs have to be held with that same strength of traditional religious convictions. But that's still a pretty subjective thing. How do you actually measure how strongly someone believes in something?
It sounds like there's a lot of room for different interpretations there.
Mm.
I bet it gets complicated trying to apply the Welsh precedent to actual cases.
It definitely adds a whole layer of complexity, yeah. And don't forget that tension between what the judges decide and what the lawmakers actually intended, which, like we said, Justice White brought up in his dissent. Welsh kind of forced the courts to make those tough calls that maybe Congress was trying to avoid.
That raises the question, how much power should the court even have to reinterpret a law, especially when the justices themselves can't even agree?
Exactly. Welsh is a perfect example of how the Supreme Court can use its interpretations to reshape how a law works in practice, sometimes in ways the people who wrote it never even imagined. This back and forth between judicial interpretation and legislative intent, that's like a constant thread running through American law.
It sounds like Welsh v. United States isn't just some interesting legal case from the Vietnam War. It's also about these bigger questions about what the judiciary's role really is, shaping and interpreting the law. Makes you think about that fine line between interpretation and, you know, what some people might call judicial activism.
You got it. Welsh gives us a framework for understanding how legal precedents change over time and how courts deal with these really complex social and political issues. It reminds us that the law isn't just sitting there unchanging. It's this dynamic thing that's constantly being reinterpreted and applied to new situations.
And that's what makes it interesting, right?
Yeah.
It's not just about memorizing rules. It's about understanding how context, interpretation, competing values, all of that shapes those rules.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Speaking of context, let's zoom out for a second. Think about how Welsh might apply in today's world. We've seen these debates about conscientious objection popping up again lately, especially around things like mandatory vaccinations.
Oh, interesting connection. So could someone today who objects to a vaccine mandate for deep moral or ethical reasons, could they use Welsh to support their objection?
It's definitely a possibility. Welsh broadened the definition of what can be considered a religious belief, remember? And that has implications for a lot of current issues. But like we've talked about, applying the Welsh test isn't always simple.
It all comes back to that sincerity thing and whether the objection is truly coming from those deeply held convictions, as opposed to just being, I don't know, a personal preference or disagreeing with a specific policy.
Yeah, you got it. And this is where things can get tricky, legally and ethically. How do you figure out the real nature of someone's objection? Where's that line between respecting individual conscience and upholding broader societal interests like public health or national security?
It feels like Welsh v. United States. Even though it was decided over 50 years ago, it's still relevant today. Raising those complex questions about individual rights, government power, and how we even define religious belief in the eyes of the law.
I agree. It's a case that makes us think critically about the intersection of law, morality, and individual conscience.
It really highlights how much our understanding of religion has shifted and how those shifts show up in legal battles and in everyday life. But before we wrap up our deep dive into Welsh v. United States with some final thoughts and a question to ponder, let's take a minute to reflect on what we've uncovered so far. All right, so we're back, ready to wrap up our deep dive into Welsh v. United States. This case has really taken us on a journey, you know, from Vietnam to the Supreme Court, exploring conscientious objection, what religion even means, and that balance between individual rights and what the government can do.
It's a case that's still unfolding decades later. Welsh shows how one legal decision can have these ripple effects, not just on the people involved, but on society as a whole.
So as we close out our discussion of Welsh, what are the key takeaways? What should our listeners really remember about why this case is still important today?
Well, I think the biggest thing is how Welsh broadened the definition of conscientious objection. It went beyond that traditional idea of organized religion and embraced these deep moral and ethical beliefs. That's a huge step in recognizing, you know, the power of individual conscience.
It's like the court was saying, it's not about having the right religious label, it's about how deeply and sincerely you hold those convictions.
Exactly. And this shift towards a more functional understanding of religion that has implications way beyond conscientious objection, it makes us rethink how we define and protect individual beliefs in a society where, you know, not everyone follows the same religious doctrines.
But like we talked about, this expansion also creates challenges, right? It raises those tough questions about where to draw the line. What's a deeply held conviction versus a strong personal preference? How do you measure sincerity? It feels like a slippery slope.
You're not wrong. It's definitely not always clear-cut. Welsh doesn't give us a perfect formula for measuring sincerity. So yeah, there's room for interpretation and maybe even misuse. The courts have been wrestling with this ever since.
And then there's that whole debate about the role of the courts, which, you know, Justice White's dissent in Welsh really highlighted. He was basically saying the court went too far, rewrote the law instead of interpreting it. Gets right to the heart of that tension between what judges do and what lawmakers intended.
Absolutely. Welsh is like a textbook example of how the Supreme Court can use its decisions to reshape the legal landscape in ways the people who wrote the law might never have imagined. This back and forth between the courts and the legislature, that's a constant theme in American law.
So Welsh v. United States is not just some historical footnote. It's a landmark case that not only changed how we think about conscientious objection, but also raises those big questions about individual rights, government power, what belief is, and the role of the courts. It still has an impact on our legal system and our conversations as a society.
Couldn't agree more. Welsh challenges us to think critically, examine our own assumptions about religion and belief, and consider how law, morality, and individual conscience all interact in this, you know, diverse and changing world.
And on that note, I want to leave our listeners with a question to think about, something that builds on what we've been discussing. We talked about how Welsh expanded conscientious objection to include those deeply held moral convictions. But what happens when those convictions lead to action? Could acts of civil disobedience, you know, those motivated by sincerely held beliefs, could those be protected under Welsh?
That's a really interesting question. It goes beyond just objecting to something and into actually resisting. It makes us think about whether and how the law should make space for people who feel morally obligated to challenge laws or policies they believe are unjust.
Yeah, it's a question without easy answers, but a crucial one as we try to understand that interplay between law, morality, and individual conscience. Welsh v. United States gives us this fascinating way to think about these questions, and I really encourage our listeners to keep wrestling with these ideas as they continue their legal studies.
I like that. Welsh reminds us that the law isn't just a set of rules, but a dynamic process. It reflects how complex human experience is and how we're always trying to balance individual freedom with the common good.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Welsh v. United States. It's been great. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp, stay curious, and don't be afraid to question things.